Early this summer, when I sketched out my preaching schedule, I was thinking mostly about biblical characters that I wanted to explore with you over these lazy, warm, quiet summer months. Enter Miriam with a tambourine in her hand. Named as a prophet in these verses we heard this morning, she performs the unique trick of biblical literature by being both larger than life and yet tucked away into the abyss of the narrative. These kinds of characters always interest me. And so I got to wondering, how could we get to know Miriam more? As I sat with this question, what first came to mind was a regular column in Vanity Fair that always fascinates me, called My Desk. You've probably seen it. In these monthly reveals of desks of various people, a photo is accompanied by a description of items on the desk in small pull-out boxes. They've done a series of My Desk about the world's most creative people, which included people like Jerry Bruckheimer and Martha Stewart, as well as their own Vanity Fair staff. Everyone's desk looked pretty tidy, at least compared to mine, both at home and at the office. But then maybe I'd have a different attitude if Vanity Fair was coming to do a photo shoot. The more I thought about it, the more I didn't really imagine Miriam with that kind of a desk. But then I pulled from one of my random piles of papers and magazines on my desk the January-February 2019 issue of the Religious Education Journal. I make a habit to at least read the editorial introduction to the journal that my friend Joyce Mercer writes. I was delighted to find her writing about the books that religious educators have on their nightstands. She pointed to her favorite section of the New York Times Book Review, where authors are interviewed, and one of the questions that they are always asked is, "What books are on your nightstand right now?" As Mercer puts it so well, this is a way of asking writers to reflect not only on what they write, but also on what they're reading, what they currently find interesting, what issues and what authors inform their thinking. Her inquiry to colleagues in the field of religious education disclosed a wide variety of genres, including various daily meditation books. A few books like Tara Westover's Educated, a memoir, and White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, received multiple mentions. This got me to thinking, though, and I started to consider what we might find on Miriam's nightstand. Her role in leading the people in the Song of the Sea in Exodus 15 is so iconic. But there is so much more to her story, and some of it we piece together from the text. I remember my first introduction to Miriam is there on the bank of the river, watching her brother rock in the papyrus basket, waterproofed by his mother with pitch and bitumen. This brother, hidden from Pharaoh, is found by none other than the daughter of Pharaoh, and is, of course, Moses. It is his sister that offers to Pharaoh's compassionate daughter to find a wet nurse for the baby. Moses' sister returns with his own mother. My childhood ears didn't quite get this at first, but I remember well my mother gently explaining it to me. And while Miriam is not named in these verses in the second chapter of Exodus, tradition holds that this sister on the riverbanks is indeed Miriam. Miriam, who is later named a prophet. Miriam, who leads her people across the sea of reeds with dancing and a tambourine. But Miriam's story doesn't end here, where the Israelite story of freedom is just beginning. Well, in Exodus, she fades away after this mention. She is quite present in the book of Numbers, particularly in one sticky incident in Numbers 12. I'll let the narrator of Numbers tell it. It goes like this. Although Moses was the most humble person in all the world, Miriam and Aaron started complaining. Moses has no right to marry that woman from Ethiopia. Who does he think he is? The Lord has spoken to us, not just to him. The Lord heard their complaint and told Moses and Aaron and Miriam to come to the entrance of the sacred tent. The Lord appeared in a cloud and told Aaron and Miriam to come closer. Then, after commanding them to listen carefully, God said, I, the Lord, speak to prophets in visions and dreams, but my servant Moses is the leader of my people, and he sees me face to face, and everything I say to him is perfectly clear. You have no right to criticize my servant Moses. And the Lord became angry at Aaron and Miriam, and after the Lord left and the cloud disappeared from over the sacred tent, Miriam's skin turned white with leprosy. When Aaron saw what had happened to her, he said to Moses, Sir, please don't punish us for doing such a foolish thing. Don't let Miriam's flesh rot away like a child born dead. And Moses prayed, Lord God, please heal her. But the Lord replied, Miriam would be disgraced for 7 days if her father had punished her by spitting in her face. So make her stay outside the camp for 7 days before coming back. The people of Israel did not move their camp until Miriam returned 7 days later. This story about Miriam is unsettling, to say the least. There's so many questions about the text. Maybe the first one being, what's the big deal about Moses marrying a woman from Ethiopia anyway? But Moses is clearly shining through rose-colored glasses in these verses as well. And while God is angry with Miriam and Aaron, it is just Miriam who is punished, seemingly diminishing her prophetic status. And yet, there is a rally around Miriam, from Aaron, and from Moses, and from the whole community. Neither the people nor her brothers will move without her. There is really no question that they will wait for her. After this story in Numbers, Miriam fades into the background again. The next mention of her in Numbers is in the first verse of the 20th chapter, where we are told that she dies and is buried. It is no coincidence that immediately after her death, there is no water for the congregation of Israelites, and Moses performs a miracle that you might be familiar with, of tapping his staff against the rock to provide water for the people at Meribah. It is rabbinic legend that connects Miriam with water. And we can see it just in these stories that we heard. The water that Moses floated on while she stood to watch. The water through which she led the Israelites away from the Egyptians. The legend is that there were waters provided by a mysterious moving well in the wilderness that only Miriam knew where it was at. Some feminist Jewish liturgists now add a glass of water to the Seder table, representing Miriam's story. She may not be mentioned continuously in the narrative of the people moving through the desert, but when she is mentioned, her presence is felt. Hebrew scholar Phyllis Tribble wrote an essay called Bringing Miriam Out of the Shadows, and that imagery is just exquisite for Miriam. Miriam is at once in the shadows and out of them. Stringing Miriam's narrative together in this way, we get a more complete idea of who she was to the Israelite people. and maybe who she can be in our spiritual lives. She is a prophet, and she is clearly not perfect. She has a very distinct role in the ethos of the Israelite people. And so, given the little bit that we do know, what might we find on Miriam's nightstand? I had some fun with this question, just looking around my own office, imagining what I might put by her bedside if she was Airbnb-ing at my apartment. First thing I chose was Robert Alter's translation of the Psalms. And I was looking for a book called That Singing Thing, A Case for Congregational Song by John Bell, but I didn't find that. I pulled out Dolores Williams's Sisters in the Wilderness about Hagar's story in the book of Exodus. That seemed like one that Miriam would read, or at least flip through. I suspect I would put some poetry on her nightstand, maybe the Iona prayer book. And surely this month there would be something by Toni Morrison, and maybe even our own Kara Wall's debut novel, The Dearly Beloved. I wouldn't be surprised if on Miriam's nightstand was a copy of Jill Hammer and Tanya Scher's The Hebrew Priestess that our friends at the New Shul, a progressive Jewish congregation with whom we share space, are reading as part of their summer read. Imagine a woman so tied to water might be reading books still about Flint, Michigan, such as What the Eyes Don't See, and about the border crisis between the United States and Mexico, where water is so scarce. Maybe something like The Line Becomes a River or Borderland Theology. Maybe she's even got some articles about the water crisis in Newark tucked between those books. You can probably think of countless other things that should be on Miriam's nightstand. One of the other ones that caught my attention, though, was a book that Mercer mentions that's on her nightstand. Made me wonder if it wouldn't be on Miriam's as well. It's called The Contemplative Mind and the Scholarship of Teaching and Learning, by a scholar named Patricia Owen Smith. Mercer explains that Owen Smith addresses the movement within contemporary education to retrieve contemplative practices and contemplative knowing as valuable and even necessary for teaching and learning. Contemplative pedagogies are those that prioritize the transformation of habits of the mind, Owen Smith says, deepening of attention and insight, understanding of the self as influenced by both interiority and exteriority, and commitment to and reflection on the experiential. As I was immersed in Miriam's story this past week and thinking about these types of teaching and learning, it occurred to me that Miriam is a practitioner of these types of contemplative pedagogies. Her leadership is experiential and relational. She moves in relationship to her brother, her mother, the people of Israel. There is something in her presence that embodies attention to habits of the mind, to reflection, to contemplation. And yet it's more than that attentiveness somehow. It's how she moves in and out of that space so easily. Maybe it is the mystery of Miriam's presence and yet lack of presence in the text that let us know that she's there, but at the same time, it doesn't burden us with every move and action the way we know about Moses and the larger congregation. Our awareness of her presence behind the scenes and in front of the scenes gives her an aura of contemplative practice and makes her an excellent mentor of contemplative ways of learning. Part of what Mercer lifts out about Owen Smith's work is the critique that a lot of religious educators share about current practices of learning, which is that stillness and awareness, attention, mindfulness, and reflection are often lost capacities for how we teach and how we learn. In our religious practices, we are uniquely positioned to lift up these ideas, and we have a unique role model in Miriam to help show us new ways to enter into those disciplines. It was the word stillness that most caught my attention on this list. I was thinking about Miriam's very active presence after the people crossed the sea. And yet so much of her presence is not active, but still. The stillness as she waited by the riverbanks, watching her brother among the reeds. The stillness as she waited 7 days for the leprosy to pass before she moved on with her people. And as we consider our own contemplative practices, the summer can be such a time for stillness in a way that we rarely let ourselves feel at other times. Contemplative practices are very much a part of our religious and our summer routines. I wonder how much we can learn as we enter into these last weeks of summer from the connection of these two aspects of our lives. Our stillness, our attentiveness, our reflections, our awareness and mindfulness often shift in these months. As Bob preached so eloquently a few weeks ago, we are encouraged to strengthen our practice of rest or Sabbath that we don't claim often enough. But here is a new reason to do so. It is not just part of replenishing our spirits and our bodies. It is not just about finally making some time to read those volumes on the nightstand. Stillness and awareness and mindfulness and reflection are not just restorative, they are transformative. As Owen Smith notes, our habits of mind have both interior and exterior impact. Miriam's stillness leads to transformations, not just for her, but for her brother, her family, and the whole people of Israel. But how? What does Miriam do differently that is a help to us? There's something about Miriam. She moves in and out of this stillness and contemplation into action. Seems to me that she is the perfect prophet for August. Because isn't that where we find ourselves today? At the threshold of stillness and transformation. We know the change the fall promises is coming. Our oldest teenagers are in final preparations or already starting college. Our younger ones are slumping toward Labor Day. Last days of freedom filling the air. Our work colleagues are starting to reappear. The sun is finishing its work earlier in the day. We are all at once eager for change and longing for that stillness to remain. Here is where Miriam's leadership in contemplative practice is needed. How do we take what we learned in the stillness of the summer forward? How do we name it and live into where we are transformed? Our own stillness and attentiveness has the potential for transformation. So much depends now on how we step in and out of that stillness in these last weeks of summer. We may be tempted to hoard it, soaking in as much stillness as we can find. But we also can take tentative steps, like Miriam, in and out of the shadows, knowing that not only have we sought to be restored, but like Miriam, our stillness has transformed us, and more possibilities hover around us, for ourselves and for the world.